Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. It is Tuesday, November the 13th. I think it's Tuesday. I've already kind of lost track of this week, I'll just admit. Wow. Some weeks you think to yourself, it can't possibly be Tuesday. I feel like I've read in for a whole week by now. I feel like we've got news and headlines that are crashing at us at such a speed. It surely must be Thursday, but it's not. It's Tuesday. So welcome to Connecting Faith. Thrilled to be here with you. You can always visit me online at my ministry website, which is reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge, and you can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. And actually, I'm going to start today with just that, with a listener email in response to a conversation that we started yesterday. So the California fires, obviously still in the headlines because the fires are still burning. And the death toll, tragically, now stands at 44, but is expected to rise even further. And so if I were going to give all this a hashtag, I would use my hashtag pray the news. And then, you know, beyond that, let us each and all be doing what we can to alleviate the suffering and the grief and the loss of those who are our neighbors in California. So yesterday when I was discussing the California fires, I talked about a comment made by California Governor Jerry Brown. He was observing that they have arrived at what he described as a new abnormal. And I made some comments about that yesterday on the show. And a listener, Sheila, took the time to email me. And I want to share with you what Sheila has said, because I think that this is sort of how the conversation is intended to go, right? This shouldn't just be a one-sided conversation on Connecting Faith. We should be communicating with one another. Like, so if there are ways that you want to react, respond to, engage, and you don't want to, you know, call or text, which is always available, 877-933-2484, you can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. So here's what Sheila has to say. She says, I started using the term new abnormal about 5 years ago after our 20-year-old son, a man of promise, a young man of promise, passed away following a seven-month battle with cancer. I've heard others refer to a new normal after losing a loved one. Ever since watching our son transition from this life to his eternal home, I've internally protested against that term. She means new normal. From my perspective, there's nothing normal about a parent losing a child. Nothing normal about saying a forced goodbye to someone who had been in the prime of life. A son who had a heart for the lost and the poor and a passion for evangelism. Someone who was talented, gifted, and loved. It was not normal for his siblings to lose a brother. Not normal for parents to arrange a memorial service for their child. It is abnormal, all caps, to live life on this earth without your child. Yet, with the help of our faithful Lord, caring friends, and a loving family, you learn to live with it. Learn to live and participate in life despite the dissonance in your heart, despite the longing to have the loved one with you, while knowing it won't happen on this side of the veil. Knowing the comfort of the knowledge that our son is eternally safe in the arms of our Heavenly Father, excuse me, and knowing that our earthly arms will never again embrace him, that isn't normal. I suppose it will never feel normal, and that's okay. I find some comfort in realizing that it is abnormal. Somehow it helps me cope. It helps me to be a little more patient with myself, with others. It helps me to exercise mercy, to be okay with brokenness. For us, it's a new abnormal. At the same time, abnormal is not synonymous with bad or wrong. Good can actually come from it. There can even be joy in the midst of mourning. Joy? Question mark. While grieving? Question mark. From the world's perspective, I guess that would appear to be rather odd, even abnormal. Friends, I know that you join me in thanking Sheila for this beautiful personal testimony, and for her vulnerability and for her graciousness, and for the way in which she entered the conversation. And so thank you. Thank you to Sheila, who is maybe out there listening today again. My heart goes out to you, and my prayers arise for you and your family. Obviously, you are allowing the Lord our God to comfort you and to walk with you. And so I just want to say thank you for engaging in the conversation. You are beautifully reconnecting the eternal with the everyday. And thank you for engaging in a conversation here on Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, if you've got a comment, you've got a story idea, you've got an angle on a story that maybe I missed, you can let me know at Carmen@myfaithradio.com. You can always communicate with me on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. So I want to turn from there to a couple of headlines today, and I'm not gonna I'm not gonna try to do something tremendously serious right now because I find Sheila's testimony so impactful and personal, and so I'm gonna pull a headline here about new government guidelines because frankly none of this is gonna surprise you, and yet maybe it will convict all of us as we enter into the holiday season, where we tend to move less and eat more and engage in social media more. And basically what all of these guidelines and studies are finding is that the opposite is what we need to be doing. So none of this is going to surprise you. There's new recommendations for a healthy life. And I will sum it up this way. Move more and be on social media less. So that is the down and dirty summary. Let me read the move more guidelines. So these are new government guidelines that basically say, you know, they're not changing the amount of exercise that we should all be getting, which our guidelines are still 150 to 300 minutes of moderate intensity exercise and 75 to 150 minutes of vigorous intensity physical activity every week, along with at least 2 days a week of muscle strengthening exercise. So those recommendations are actually unchanged from a decade ago. But what they are saying is sit less and move more. Whatever you do, it really counts. So, you know, if you're saying to yourself, no way I can do 300 minutes, that's 5 hours, of moderate exercise every week, let alone 150 minutes of vigorous or higher intensity exercise, let alone add to that 2 days of, you know, where I'm doing something that's strength training. You know, you say, well, I can't do all of that, so I'm going to do none of it. And what they're saying is sit less, move more. Whatever you do, it really counts. So Thomas Allison, director of sports and exercise cardiology at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, who could be listening right now. And so a little shout out if you happen to be listening in the Twin Cities area on our Faith Radio affiliates. Thomas Allison said short bouts of exercise are valuable to break up long stretches of sitting. Research shows that multiple short sessions should involve similar energy expenditure in order to have the same impact as one longer session. In addition, or additional time moving is going to be needed. Which basically what he's saying is, look, if all you're going to do is get up and walk around the office instead of like standing up and doing vigorous jumping jacks for 7 minutes, which would be, by the way, a great way to get your heart rate up. Like there are now apps that's like the 7 minute workout and there's like the 8 minute workout. So there are geniuses out there who have already said to themselves, you know what? Better to get people moving at a high intensity for a short period of time than have them not move at all. So sit less, move more. That's the first recommendation. The second recommendation comes from a study at the University of Pennsylvania. And I don't have it right in front of me. Okay, here we go. So this is no more FOMO, which is fear of missing out. Limiting social media decreases loneliness and depression. This is from the University of Pennsylvania. Maybe you heard my conversation yesterday with Bruce Ashford, where we talked about the connection of depression to loneliness, to isolation, and how that can be a really downward spiral. And that the answer to, at least part of the answer to that, is if we recognize that we are moving in the direction of depression or we are depressed, that not doing things that sort of contribute to what we know is loneliness and contributors to loneliness, like we should be avoiding those things. So social media actually makes us feel more lonely and more isolated. It makes us feel bad. And now we actually have a study taking some of that correlative research and linking social media to people actually not only feeling worse, but actually being depressed. So you can experience a significant reduction in loneliness and depression by not only increasing your self-monitoring, which means setting a timer when you go onto any social media platform, but limiting your total amount of social media to 30 minutes a day. So that's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, whatever social media platforms you're on. Limit your total exposure to all of that to 30 minutes a day. So if you're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, that's 10 minutes each per platform per day. And that's it. And you won't have a fear of missing out because you are going to self-monitor and you're going to say, hey, I actually feel better when I'm on there less over time. Because there is a correlation between the amount of time we spend on social media and how we actually feel about ourselves, others, and the world around us. All right, friends, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're just going to continue looking at some headlines of the day. There's actually a new trend across America, and I want to talk about it. It is Take Your Parents to Work Day. I don't know. Mom, do you want to come sit in the studio? If so, you're more than welcome. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. We'll be right back. Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. You can always find the show online at myfaithradio.com. You could go there, you could download the podcast, you could share today's show with someone new, and that would be a great blessing all the way around. So there you go. If you're looking for something to share at Thanksgiving, you know, right? You could say, hey, I listened to this show. I think maybe you would find it edifying. It would provide conversations for us to have with each other. And so you could invite folks to check us out. Right? All right. There you go. Get other people connected on Connecting Faith. So here's a headline for you. Concerning your boss. Oh, cornering your boss. Not concerning your boss. I know what this article is about. It's about bringing your parents to work. So now I got to read the actual headline. Cornering your boss, snapping pictures at your desk. It's Take Your Parents to Work Day. The subhead. Eager to see what their adult offspring do all day, moms and dads embrace office visits. It's almost like we're in a zoo and we're the animals, workers say. So this is posted in the Wall Street Journal. So, you know, reputable reporting agency letting us know that there is now a trend all across the country where parents are turning up at offices to see what their adult children are doing. It's a part of an event trend called Bring Your Parents to Work Day. So part of me is like super curious if anybody has experienced this, either as, as a laborer whose parents have come to their office or as a parent who has actually done this. Like you've actually, I'm sure by the tone of my voice, you can tell that I find this kind of curious. Here's some quotes from the article. Companies see it as a way to please young employees who are frankly still very close to their moms and dads. Now, this reminded me that we have a lot of folks still living at home, even when they are in their, you know, in their first or second job. Watching people talk on the phone and tap out emails might not sound exciting to you, but it seems to delight this crowd. And they provide, they have like they set up photo booths, they set up like buffet lunches. And then there are these times where, you know, the leader of the organization comes in and talks. I know. So there you go. That's what's going on out there at Take Your Parent to Work Day. Now, I wanted to share this because here's my idea. For those of you who have a Take Your Parent to Work Day at your office, and you got a parent who lives across the country, so they're not going to come to Take Your Parent to Work Day. I want you to like conscientiously acknowledge that God the Father, your Father, is with you at work every single day. Every single day for the Christian is Take Your Parent to Work Day. Every single day is Take Your Older Brother to Work Day, because you and I are not going to work and leaving God like out in the car or at home or at church, right? So every day for the Christian is Take Your Parent to Work Day, specifically Take Your Father to Work Day. So I wanted to I wanted to just lift this up as a trend going on in the culture and then just make that eternal connection for us in terms of what we're really doing when we're out there laboring. Here's a disturbing headline. I'm doing kind of a quick run through today because I have so many things I want to talk about. And some of them don't really need a deep dive because of, frankly, how obvious they are. So here's a headline for you. This is off Business Insider. A Victoria's Secret executive has apologized for making insensitive comment about transgender models. Now, what's going on here? Well, first of all, the fact that Victoria's Secret has not only this, you know, they have an iconic runway show. They obviously have stores, but they have a fashion show that's then turned into a television special, maybe as a way of thinking about it. So that's what we're talking about here. They are filming that event, and it was at the filming of that event that backstage this Victoria's Secret executive said he didn't think transgender models should be cast in the lingerie brand's annual fashion show. Why? Well, he said because the fashion show is a fantasy. Now, if taken at his word that that's really the reason why, then transgender models should absolutely be included. If it's a fantasy, then I think the inclusion of transgender models makes perfect sense. But it's not. That's not what he means, and that's not what he's talking about. He's talking here about the pornification of the culture and the role of Victoria's Secret in it and just exactly what they're selling while those models are on those catwalks and what they're doing. So he actually says we market who we sell to, and we don't market to the whole world. All right, so when you think about that, what is he saying? And this was in the context of a conversation about why they don't use plus size models. They don't use plus size models because, frankly, they tried that and the audience had no interest in it. They still don't. So we're not talking about marketing to women. We're not talking about marketing to the people who are going to wear these articles of clothing. We're talking about an audience. This is pornographic voyeurism. To state it so plainly might hurt your feelings, but that's what this is. And so when he says we market to who we sell to, he knows his market is men. And men who are interested in watching the Victoria's Secret fashion show do not want to be wondering whether or not they are watching a biological man who is wearing an outfit from Victoria's Secret. That is really what this comes down to. And this executive who made these comments, he is actually worried about the bottom line of his company. He's actually worried about the dollars and cents here. But you will remember that the headline is that he apologized for making insensitive comments. So here is the full statement retracting what he said. My remark regarding the inclusion of transgender models in the Victoria's Secret fashion show came across as insensitive. I apologize. To be clear, we absolutely would cast a transgender model for the show. We've had transgender models come to castings, and like many others, they didn't make it. But it was never about gender. I admire and respect their journey to embrace who they really are. That is fantasy. We had a conversation on the way to school this morning about the Dutch man who is 69 who has sued the government for his birthday to be changed by 20 years so that he would be recognized as 49, which is the age with which he identifies. And here's the reality. If sex is mutable, then why is age or race not mutable? The person in the vehicle with me, who's quite young, said, hey, that sounds a lot like the emperor who has no clothes. That story about, a fashion designer who is supposedly making an outfit for the emperor, but it's invisible. There's no there there. And yet the emperor comes to believe the lie, and everybody else agrees to believe the lie and participate in the lie, and you end up in culture-wide delusion. And so I just feel really strongly that we as Christians have to keep pointing to the reality of what is real. Sex in terms of maleness and femaleness is real. It's a biological reality. And it's also a created order reality. Race is a biological genetic reality. And so is age, by the way, just in case you weren't clear that the way I think about this lawsuit that has been brought in the Netherlands. Okay, and just to highlight one more note of confusion about all of this. In the New York Times magazine, there is an article that appears that the title of which is Letter of Recommendation, Women's Clothing. Now, this is written by a person. If you read the entire article, you will discover that this person is a biological male. He identifies as male, and he is attracted to women. That makes him what in the culture today is called cisgender. So there's a sentence in this article that says, I am a cisgender man. I present that way. But sometimes my outfits are a mixture of what is labeled men's and women's. So he does not describe what he's doing as cross-dressing. He describes it as cross-shopping. He believes that cross-shopping in the women's department gives him a liberating sense of control over himself and his body, not necessarily overturning the designations of a gender, but instead widening my version of manhood. I feel truest to me, he says. I believe no one is entirely masculine or feminine. So again, now we're talking here about redefining roles and redefining our engagement with one another along a spectrum as opposed to a binary reality. And so this is a man who shops in both the women's department and the men's department and puts outfits together from both. You are seeing a rise in the culture of men wearing more and more makeup. And I just think that as all of that is happening, you and I, we can't run from those conversations. We actually have to lean in and have conversations about what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be male? What does it mean to be female? Why do our bodies matter? We have talked here before about Nancy Piercy's book, Love Thy Body. If you have not gotten that as a resource, I highly recommend it. Next up, I'm actually going to have a conversation that is attached to this one, grows out of this one, with Christian theologian and bioethicist Brent Waters. He's going to share from his book, This Mortal Flesh, Incarnation and Bioethics. We're going to talk about whether or not the human body matters. Maybe just the mind matters. So what are we, and what are we to make of sort of the variety of definitions of transhumanism that we hear emerging in our culture, and how does the fact of the incarnation of Jesus, how does the fact of his physical embodiment and his bodily resurrection, his bodily ascension, his promised second coming, how do those inform us as believers as we consider the growing number of options to technologically and medically enhance our lives? I'm Carmen LeBird. You are listening to Connecting Faith. Next up, my conversation with Brent Waters. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LeBurge, honored to be joined in conversation today by Dr. Brent Waters. He is a professor of Christian social ethics at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary, and he writes widely in the area of Christian ethics, and we're going to talk today specifically about his book, This Mortal Flesh, Incarnation and Bioethics. Dr. Waters, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, thank you for having me.
So this is deep subject matter, and yet I think that it's really important and fruitful subject matter for us to engage in as Christians. Medical advancements and particularly medical technologies, but other technologies as well, we can celebrate, and you do, that those are used to reduce human suffering. But you spend a lot of time warning about the dangers of what we could describe as a post-human project. Talk with us about sort of the danger of rejecting the body and what our bodies have to do with being human.
Well, right now there's a group called the transhumanists who are very much on the forefront of this. What they advocate is using technology, and it's various forms of technology, biotechnology, information technology, artificial intelligence, to begin to really create a creature or a being that's better than human. So what they want to do is the ultimate goal is to achieve personal immortality, and that can be done through various kinds of methods, either just simply through biotechnology, extending a lifespan, or combining it to make a bionic being, or even a uploading a person's information and then downloading it into robotic hosts. So it's a very ambitious enterprise, and I think the danger of that is we forget that we're creatures created by God, and we were created by God as mortal and finite creatures.
So some of those things that you just mentioned, I'm sure that there are folks listening who are there like, what is he even talking about? Uploading my mind in order that it might be downloaded into a robotic host. Is that even possible? And so some of what we're talking about is not yet possible, but people are diligently working on those kinds of technologies.
Right. The hope for the transhumanists is that we will develop very sophisticated scanning devices that they can scan the brain. They assume that the information that is scanned can eventually be reduced to a series of zeros and ones, which is digital technology, and then reorganized into different patterns and downloaded into different kinds of hosts. So what they're really claiming is that the person, you or me, is simply information, and nature hasn't provided us a very good host because it doesn't last very long.
So I would love to spend some time just talking with my audience, having taken up your challenge and reread Huxley's 1932 classic, How Brave a New World. But I will probably save that for another episode because you and I have a limited amount of time. But I would. But how about recognizing where we are in terms of all of those things that Huxley sort of predicts? He's very prescient. Where do you think we are in terms of sort of seeking after this post-human project?
Well, I think we're fairly far down the road already in terms of just simply extending longevity. I mean, medical science has been very successful if you can get access to certain kinds of therapies of extending life. We're already starting to use some artificial devices, artificial blood vessels, in some cases, also the interface between human brains and digital technology is already a possibility and already being used, and very sophisticated prosthetics for replacements for arms and legs. So really, we need to look at every therapy as potentially an enhancement as well. And that's where I think the breakthroughs are going to come, is that initially, therapies will be used for enhancements for everyday life.
As soon as you use the word access, and I think that's an important word in this conversation, I think we can recognize that a very limited number of people are ever going to have access to the kinds of things that we're talking about because they are so expensive. So talk with us about the concept of selfishness in this conversation.
Well, I think it is an extreme form of selfishness, almost narcissistic, because what's very interesting in the transhumanist literature is that there's almost no conversations, nothing written about the good of having children. Because if you really think of it, if your goal is personal immortality, you begin to believe you don't need offspring. You don't need to have one generation passing life on to another. And I think there again, that's a core belief in the Christian faith. Is the intergenerational aspect of one generation giving way to the next and passing on certain kinds of things. So it really fundamentally changes, I think, how one understands what it means to be human, and I think that's the danger of it over time. Now, you're right, the technologies will be expensive, at least initially. But like most technologies, eventually the cost will come down, and how widespread the access will be, I think, just remains to be seen.
Friends, I'm talking with Dr. Brent Waters. He is an ethics professor at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary. We're talking about his book, This Mortal Flesh, The Incarnation and Bioethics. And we're also talking about how it is that we are going to be more critical in our approach to the adoption of technologies. And so let's move there, Dr. Waters. I think that initially we can say, oh, it's just too expensive and it's out of reach anyway. And so we can say, well, I don't have to make a decision of that because it's not available. But as you just pointed out, technology is always finding ways to make itself cheaper. And so the day comes when the Christian has to decide whether or not they are going to adopt a particular technology or receive a particular treatment or subject their child to a particular treatment or enhancement. Talk with us about critical decision making for Christians in light of where we are in our culture.
Right. Well, I think it really comes to begin with is for Christians, we believe that embodiment is, well, it's good to be embodied. That's how we were created. And to be finite and mortal is not a curse. Because I think we need to think of our lives somewhat like stories, and all good stories come to an end with a final good chapter. If you would attempt to live forever, then it's no longer a story. It's this pointless rhetoric because it goes on and on and on. And that's one way, I think, to begin to think about it. But I think in terms of more practical things, we have to think about is, you know, will we resist enormous pressures to enhance our children, you know, through genetic enhancement or other forms of technological enhancement? I think that's where it will first begin. And then we also have to think about you know, fundamental questions. What does it mean to live a good and faithful life? And what is a good and faithful death as the end of that life? And those aren't necessarily morbid topics. I think they're actually very important because it really gives our lives a point to which we're heading toward.
When you, in your conversations and in your teaching, when you think about the concept of human dignity, what does that include?
Well, I think it includes foremost that we were created in the image and likeness of God, that we were created for a purpose, namely, and that purpose is to love and serve God forever, as it says in the Catechism. I think that that's really the beginning point of dignity, is to realize that dignity is not something which is given to us by others. It's given to us by God. We're born with it.
All right, you give yourself away when you refer to the Catechism. My audience is all chuckling. They're like, ooh, he's a Westminster guy. So there you go. We are talking with Dr. Brent Waters. He is a professor of ethics at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary. You can find his faculty page on the garrett.edu website. You can also find his author page at Amazon. We're talking about his book, This Mortal Flesh, The Incarnation and Bioethics. When we you make reference to this in the book, and I would love for you to talk about this for a minute. Our 21st century, you know, sort of medical technology and advances, you describe as reviving some ancient heresies. Can you tell us maybe what a couple of those are and how we can identify them?
Well, one of the heresies is Pelagianism, which is a search for perfection on our own terms. And I think that that's really what the transhumanist project is about, is trying to make something perfect as defined to what they think perfection is. Now, the problem with every time humans try to define what perfection is, they get it wrong. And consequently, the effort to, in this case, perfect human beings would probably come out very, very badly, because that historically has been the case. Another heresy is Manichaeism, which makes a sharp division between body and soul. So that, for example, they see that the body is simply a prison and then the soul is liberated from it. But that means then that we despise our bodies. And that's not a Christian belief. I mean, you can't believe in the incarnation in which the Word is made flesh and God is pleased to become a human being and dwell among us and hate the body, because that is to essentially hate what God has created. So I think those are the two predominant heresies that come back. And that's the interesting thing about heresy. It's not that it's completely wrong. It's a half-truth that tries to pose as a full truth, and that's why it never goes away completely.
You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about just the theology of the body itself and how helpful this conversation could be with young people who are confused about the body that they are in, those who are confused about a theology of the body in terms of what the church is and how it's supposed to function. And why every part matters. And then the reality of the body of Christ, I mean, as incarnate in flesh and then bodily resurrected from the dead, I think that when we start talking about, they're not just basic theological concepts, it's reality that we are being reminded of and bringing it to bear in the culture in which we live. And we have a lot of folks in the culture who might say they believe in Jesus, but when you start talking about, you know, that he physically took on flesh, that he is, you know, co-eternal with the Father, and he took on flesh to dwell among us, that requires that you have a conversation about a virgin birth, which they're very uncomfortable with. Or on the other end, when you start having a conversation about the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, you got a lot of people that simply don't believe that ever happened. And so I do think that this conversation about incarnation and resurrection and the bioethics of our day and the reality of our bodies and Christ's body, this is so timely.
Well, yeah, I think it is. And I think the interesting thing that I'm working on now in terms of bioethics is a book called Disembodied Bioethics, in which I try to say, look, in my lifetime, the body has changed from an object of care to a problem to be solved. How did we get there? And that's what I'm trying to trace, is this notion that our bodies are somehow something that gets in the way of what we want to do, when in fact it is through our bodies that we live and serve the Lord. So it really is fascinating to me how the body became a problem to be solved rather than an object to be cared for.
Okay, that is fascinating. Will you come back when that book comes out and we can talk again?
Well, Lord willing, yes.
Hey, friends, my guest is Brent Waters. The book is This Mortal Flesh, The Incarnation and Bioethics. You can find his faculty page at the Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary website, which is Garrett, Garrett.edu. He is Brent Waters. Thank you so much for being with us here today on Connecting Faith.
Well, thank you.
All right, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll be making the connecting point. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. We're going to spend a couple of minutes here making the connecting point. Ultimately, when we are going to engage in conversations with folks who identify as transhumanist, who want to have conversations about being better than human or creating something that is post-human, you and I as Christians are going to have to bring the reality of what it means to be human to bear. And so some of us have become adept at those conversations because of our immersion in pro-life conversations and the pro-life issue. So the conversation of what does it mean to be human? And obviously, when we talk about what it means to be human, there is something related to biology there. And there's something related to the physical body. There's also something beyond that, above that, below that, I don't know, around that, in it. And so I think that let's just have a quick conversation here about a very profound question. What does it mean to be human? What does that mean? And so I think that for me, I would probably start with the concept of being a creature. Now, that is not where everybody's going to start this conversation, right? Some people are going to start the conversation about what does it mean to be human as currently the highest order of evolved beings. And this is where one segment of the transhumanist population is interested in then going beyond what would be defined as the currently highest order being in, not in creation, they wouldn't use that term, in evolutionary biology, and having something that is both biological and technological and therefore surpasses in every way, they would argue, that which is human. So that they're looking for post-human, not necessarily transhuman. Unless that what they mean by human is transcending what is understood as human. Like, right? So I think that anytime you see the word transhuman or transhumanist, you have to ask the person how they're defining that term. We had Newton Lee on just last Friday. He clearly does not see himself as a Christian transhumanist, as a person who is interested in this hybrid of human and technology that would leave the body behind, nor that would in any way seek to create something that is no longer actually human. So, so you have to ask how they're defining the term. Anytime you talk with somebody who is engaging in a conversation with transhumanists about transhumanism or where that term is used. And so let me just encourage you on that front. It's one of those important conversations. On the subject of what it means to be human, I think you have to ask that question as well. And bioethics includes conversations at both ends of life and everything in between. And so one of the things that Brent Waters encourages people to do in the very first chapter of his book is to go back and reread Huxley's 1932 classic, How Brave a New World. And so because I try to be a good student, I didn't actually go back and reread the entirety of Huxley's book, but I did go back and sort of revisit it, scan through it, you know, went to the Wikipedia page, you know, those kinds of things. And I was reminded at just how prescient Huxley is when he's describing the Brave New World. Let me just go through this list really quickly. In Huxley's 1932 book, 1932, just think about that. That's a long time ago. He's looking forward at what he describes as a brave new world. Now, this is not a positive forecasting of the future. This is dystopian at some level. Huxley's images include a ruling elite of technologically enhanced alpha people, recreational sex that's delinked from reproduction and from family, from marriage, an extensive use of reproductive technology, a society that is dependent on continuous consumption, old men who are preoccupied with what we would now call virtual reality golf, and taking male performance-enhancing drugs and utilizing other technologies that enable them to continue doing things in their old age that biologically they weren't meant to do. Universal self-medication, people actually medicating themselves out of reality. A culture-wide disgust for those who are old, sick, or disabled. And what we would now call physician-assisted suicide or even active euthanasia, in Huxley's book, for people in nursing homes, but you and I would recognize that for anyone that has become a quote-unquote burden to society. We're there. We live there. All of those things are true of the world in which we now live in 21st century America. I mean, we live in the brave new world that Huxley described in 1932. So if you want to revisit that book, that would be a really good conversation starter, enhancer. So when we talk about what it means to be human, it can't mean that we have self-medicated ourselves out of conscious awareness, or that we are enhancing our bodies in such ways that we are really no longer what could be described as biologically human, or that we are downloading our brain matter into something and then living, then getting that uploaded into some sort of robotic reality, virtual reality, artificial intelligence, as you go down the list of things, right? And so I don't want us to be afraid of technology. I want us to be people who are wise and discerning and have a critical adoption of technologies. I want us to ask different questions than the culture is often asking about things. Just because it's possible doesn't mean that it's good. Just because it's possible doesn't mean that we should do it as Christians, should embrace it, should engage in it. So when I go down my list of what does it mean to be human, I'm going to start with the concept of being a creature, and not just any creature. A creature that's actually intentionally made in the image of the Creator, in the image of God. I am a creature, and therefore I am finite, but I am made on purpose and for a purpose by a Creator. And so that means I'm accountable to the Creator. So I am a creature. I am an image bearer. I am finite. I am accountable. I am relational. I am morally responsible. I'm creative and industrious. We were actually made for work and for rest in a cycle. And so, you know, I'm not a human doing. I am a human being, and I am made in the image of the God who describes himself as being. I am the God who is. I am not a disembodied spirit, nor am I merely a conscious mind. I'm a person of substance, with substance. And if matter doesn't matter, and if matter didn't matter, then Jesus would not have bothered to condescend from the spiritual to the fleshly. Like, the whole reality of the incarnation indicates to us that matter matters, that we matter, but not just us. Matter itself matters. All creation is groaning with eager longing for man's redemption because matter matters. There's going to be a new heaven and a new earth, not just disembodied souls floating around somewhere. There's going to be a new Jerusalem. Like, these are like concrete, physical, matter-of-fact realities. If matter didn't matter, there would have been no incarnation. And if matter didn't matter, if our bodies didn't matter, Jesus would not have embodied himself in the form of a human, nor would he have risen from the dead bodily. I mean, matter clearly matters. He ascended into heaven. He is seated right now at the right hand of the Father, and he is coming again to judge the living and the dead in a body. And he's coming for a body, and that's the body of Christ. All right, I want to conclude today with another email that I received, and it is a call to prayer. So get ready to radically shift gears here at the last couple of minutes. This is a request from a dear friend who is currently overseas. She is in the Middle East. She is serving with a Christian group that ministers to refugees. She's currently in Jordan. They're headed to Iraq. And she has written a request for prayer. And so I am leveraging my relationship with you to get prayers rising for this individual and her team that she's with. So I'll just read what she has written. I am asking you for prayer, and I am asking that you would ask others to pray as well. I was asked here to counsel a Christian girl who had been kidnapped by ISIS. She was then sold 13 times to different groups. I won't here read the descriptions of what happened to her. When she was freed from ISIS, her parents would not take her in because, as is culturally understood, she shamed her family. The church did take her in and is seeking to minister to her. I so wish to be covered in prayer, cover our team in prayer. Please tell everyone that you know to intercede for us. And here's what they're asking for: divine wisdom, divine appointments, divine and anointed words. They're praying that shackles would be broken, that many would be set free from the traumas they have experienced. Pray that the Holy Spirit would delete files of pain and loss. Pray that God will empower us to do his work with humility and joy, and that when they leave and move on to the next place, that God would not only go before them, but prepare them for those divine appointments by his divine wisdom and give them divine and anointed words in the next place they serve as well. We're also asked to pray for the people of the church who are going to remain right there, that they would be able to sufficiently walk the very long road of recovery that is ahead with these girls. And so let us not forget today or any day that we are blessed and that it's a privilege to pray, and that is a privilege won for us by Jesus Christ, who gives us access to the Father unfettered. Friends, you've been listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. You can visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com, or you can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.